Good morning and welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show, where we the people are now in session. I'm your host, Sarah Schultz, and we've got a great show coming up for you today. I'll have Sam Pizzagatti. He is the editor of a weekly newsletter called Too Much. Sam Pizzagatti is now on. He is the chief editor of Too Much Online and Inequality.org. And why don't you tell us a little bit more about your background? You've done a lot, Sam. And welcome to the Sarah Schultz Show, by the way.
Thank you. Good morning. Yes, Sarah. Well, I come out of the labor movement, and now I'm an associate fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington. We have a number of projects. You mentioned two of them. We do inequality.org, which is a portal to the world of economic inequality information. So it's some place that people can come, find basic statistics, find the latest articles about economic inequality, find all sorts of different background pieces. And then we also do Too Much, which is a weekly newsletter. People can sign up at inequality.org for this newsletter. You get it in your email inbox every Monday. And what it does is looks at the inequality world of the past week and brings everybody up to date on what's going on and what folks offers all sorts of information that can help folks prosecute the struggle against inequality.
And if you have any questions for Sam, you can call in at 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896. Now, you've done a lot of research addressing economic inequality in America. Can you speak to that?
Yes. Well, I think people know the basic contours of the story, and that is over the past 30 years in the United States, we've done a complete about-face. For the 30 years before that, in other words, in the middle of the 20th century, we were becoming substantially more equal as a nation. But over the past three-odd decades, we've gone in the opposite direction. We've gone fundamentally more unequal. I mean, I like to give one set of statistics to give to me a real visceral sense of that. In 1955, in the middle of the Eisenhower era, if you look at the richest 400 Americans at that time, those richest 400 Americans averaged $13 million in income in 1955, and that's after adjusting for inflation. So that's $13 million in our dollars. In 2007, which is the most recent year we have statistics for in this country for the top 400, the top 400 income earners earned $270 million. So in other words, the top 400 went from $13 million each in 1955 to $270 million each average in 2007. And again, that's adjusting for inflation, so we're comparing apples to apples here. But it gets even more fantastic when you consider the taxes people paid. In 1955, those richest 400, folks who were averaging $13 million a year, after exploiting every loophole in the federal tax code they could find, these richest 51.2% of their total incomes in federal income tax, over half. In 2007, the richest 400 who were making $270 million a year, they only paid 18.1% of their incomes in taxes. So in other words, the richest 400 in 1955 were 20 times poorer than the richest 400 in 2007, yet the richest 400 in 1955 paid taxes at almost triple the rate of the richest 400 folks in 2007.
Well, what's causing this disparity? I mean, what caused that kind of a raise? Is it the tax loopholes? Is it the tax cuts? What are we talking about here?
Well, essentially, there have been two gigantic institutional shifts in the United States since the middle of the 20th century, since the Eisenhower years that we were just talking about. One shift has been the tax code. Back in the 1950s, income over $400,000 faced a 91% top marginal tax rate. The top marginal tax rate today is 35%, and capital gains income, which is where most of the super rich get their income from, capital gains income only faces a 15% tax. So we've had this sea change in the tax code, and that's had an incredible impact. But the other huge institutional shift has been in the labor market. Back in the middle of the 20th century, over a third of the private sector workforce carried union cards. And unions essentially set the tone for the entire wage economy, because outside the South, the majority of folks in the private sector belong to unions. Today, it's exact opposite. Less than 8% of the private sector workforce today belongs to unions. And if you look across the United States, we have vast swatches of our country where private sector unionism essentially does not exist. And in a situation like that, we have growing inequality right in the workplace, where the rewards that our corporations create are going disproportionately to the people who run those corporations, to top executives, and workers are getting the short end of the stick. So you compare those two institutional factors, changing tax code, the decline of unions across the United States, and you have an explanation for a huge share of the inequality that we're seeing today.
Now, Sam, you mentioned the South. What sets them apart from the rest of the country?
Historically, it's been two things. One, it's been the super racism and the lack of unions in the South. Both of those factors have combined to keep the South what historians would call sort of a peonage economy, where wealth is tremendously maldistributed. And in a situation like that, you don't get healthy development, and that's why the South has been so different from the United States. But unfortunately, what's happened over the past three decades is the rest of the United States has become more like the South.
Well, why weren't there any unions in the South? What was the cause for the unions not being able to get there?
The racism played a huge part. In the 1890s, in the original populist movement, there was a real effort to join white and black workers. And for a few years in the 1890s, in places like Georgia, that was incredibly successful. But that movement was subjected to a huge surge of repression. And by the end of the 19th century, the hopes for that interracial working class alliance were broken. We had the institution of Jim Crow, and all of that set back not only race relations, but trade union organizing in the South for generations.
So how does the concept of right to work play or not play in the South? So the right to work ideas, how does that?
Well, that was the particular tool that was used in the South and in many other parts of the country as well, to keep unions from getting a foothold in the economy. In states where you have right to work laws, all sorts of studies have shown you have much weaker unions, and you have a much more top-heavy distribution of income and wealth as a result.
So basically, by the decimation of the unions, then the CEOs of basically the 1% just is able to get richer while the workers have no say in what and how much they're getting.
Yes, that sounds simple, but it's absolutely correct. The power the checks and balances that we used to have in the economy, checks and balances that a vibrant trade union movement was able to provide, those checks and balances are largely gone. And we have a situation where the people who run, the executives who run our giant corporations have very little obstacles in front of them, no matter what they can do. So they can play games with their corporations, they can merge and purge, they can downsize, they can outsource, they can change full-time jobs to temporary jobs, they can do essentially whatever they want, and to feather their own nests, and at the expense of working people.
Well, who is the 1%? Can you define that? Because we hear it a lot, the 1%, the 99%, but who exactly in a monetary value are the 1%?
Okay, well, there are all sorts of different ways of measuring that, of course. You can measure it by wealth, you can measure it by income, you can measure it before tax income, after tax income. So there are all sorts of ways of doing it. So you may hear different figures, it doesn't mean the different figures are necessarily wrong. Let me just throw out a couple of you. The most recent wealth figures we have from the Federal Reserve Board, good through as of 2009, say that to enter the richest 1% as defined by wealth, you have to have a private fortune of $6.9 million. So that's one measurement. The Congressional Budget Office, which is a nonpartisan agency here in Washington, their most recent research released earlier this month, looked at after-tax household incomes in 2007 and said after-tax, the top 1% started at $252,000. Remember, that's after-tax, not before-tax income. So there are various ways of computing that, and but essentially, I think what we're talking about, if you make substantially over $250,000 a year, if you hold over $6 million in wealth, you're in the top 1%. But it's also important to notice that that within the top 1%, there's a huge amount of inequality. So the bulk of the wealth of the top 1% is not evenly divided in that top 1%. It's very much concentrated at the top one-tenth of 1%, the ultra-rich.
Wow. So even the 1%, there's a... they're in layers as well. So the bottom of the 1% is looked down upon by the top of the 1%, even.
That absolutely true. Last week, a global financial analyst firm did an analysis of global wealth of the ultra high net worth individuals of the world. These were people that this financial analyst firm defined as people with at least $30 million of private wealth. And there are 57,000 of those folks in the United States. They have almost $8 trillion between them. They average, I think the figure is $131 million each. These are the super rich of the United States.
And I'm going to get back to that, but I wanted you to define who the middle class is. Now we know what the 1% is. Who are the middle class?
Okay, the middle class, the statistical middle class. Let's look at that Congressional Budget Office study that came out earlier this month. If you look at the middle 60% of the United States economic income distribution, these are folks whose incomes would start at about $19,000 and go up to $60,000. This is the statistical middle class. This is the middle 60% of the United States. So the bottom 20% is everybody below $19,000 a year. The top 20% is everybody above $60,000 a year. And between that $20,000 and $60,000 a year figure, that's where 60% of the American people live right now.
So basically, the middle class between $19,000 and $60,000.
Right. This is it. Now, this is after tax. This is after tax that we're talking about.
Sure. So that's the bulk of the people.
That's the bulk of the people. That's the bulk of the people. So you see, there's a vast difference between that middle class and the top 1%. But I think it's very important to remember how much this has changed in the United States, how different we are today from what we were 50 and 60 years ago. In the workplace, for instance, CEOs today, our institute in Washington just released a study in September. We found that that in 2010, CEOs in the United States of major companies averaged 325 times more than the annual pay of average workers in the United States. In the early 1980s, that figure was a little over 40 times. So we've gone from a 40 times ratio in 1980 to 325 today.
Is that due to the what's called the Reaganomics?
Well, the Reaganomics is one factor there. The decline in unions is another a factor there. All these different developments have combined to increase the power of the corporate elite at the expense of average workers, and the pay, the pay distribution in corporate America reflects that power imbalance.
Now, according to your weekly publication, Too Much, 0.1% of the bottom 60% moved into the 1%. I'm gonna repeat this when I'm done. So if you don't catch it the first time, for my listeners, I'll do it a second. Of the 20% right above the 60%, 0.3% moved into the top 1%. Again, I'm gonna repeat that. 0.1% of the bottom 60% moved into the 1%, and of the 20% right above that 60%, 0.3% moved into the top 1%. Are we in America looking at becoming an economic caste system?
Well, I think we really are, and there are all sorts of studies have shown that there is less social and economic mobility today in the United States than in the rest of the developed world. The UK and the United States, which are the two most unequal developed nations in the world, have the lowest rates of economic mobility. And those are essentially fancy words for saying that if you're born in a low-income household in the United States, you have a much greater shot of staying there in the cohort of low-income houses than in other nations. And if you're born at the top in the United States, you have a much better chance of staying there at the top than is the situation in other nations.
Well, how many people in the middle class get to break into the 1%?
It's very few. I don't have the exact figures in front of me. I do have one figure that I was working on yesterday, that between 2007 and 2009, before the Great Recession hit, and then a year after the 2008 crash, 98% of the people who were in the top 1% in 2007 were still in the top 10% in 2009. So in other words, we had this great crash, but when the dust settled, everybody in that top 1% was still very, very comfortable.
So, you know, the Republican Party uses this American Dream idea to getting their base to support their policies that seem to only support the 1%. But according to the stats that I just read, that we were just talking about, the people who are supporting these ideals are really being misled, because really there's no chance for them forgetting the American dream due to the policies that they are supporting.
Well, that's the great political irony of our time, that we have sizable numbers of people who are voting for policies that are not in their economic the best interest. Until we solve that politically and socially in the United States, we're going to be continuing to be in the situation we're in now. But that's why I'm so enthusiastic about the Occupy Wall Street movement, because the Occupy Wall Street movement has put the issue of income inequality right on the political front burner. And I think people in Wisconsin deserve a incredible lot of kudos for that happening, because the struggle in Wisconsin that began earlier this year played a prime role in inspiring the Occupy Wall Street movement. And I'm just very hopeful and very optimistic that this surge is going to continue to grow and continue to impact and continue to change our politics.
We're talking with Sam Pizzagatti. He is the editor of Too Much. We're going to go to a quick break, but if you have any questions for Sam, you can call us at 877-497-1797 or 310-742-1896, and we'll be right back.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. I'm getting more and more concerned about the excessive force that police departments are using against nonviolent participants in the Occupy movement. We all know about the Iraq war vet Scott Olson, who got his skull fractured in Oakland after police shot a tear gas canister that hit his head. They also shot another tear gas canister into the crowd of people who went to help him, by the way. Then in Berkeley last week, police used their batons to jab and poke totally peaceful protesters. Police even forced a professor down on the ground and handcuffed and arrested her. And on Sunday in Chapel Hill, more than 25 officers, some brandishing semi-automatic rifles, stormed a building the protesters were occupying. They made people get on the ground and pointed guns right at their heads. They arrested 8 people and handcuffed a reporter from the News and Observer. In Portland, police also dressed in full riot gear and made 50 arrests. Protesters reportedly chanted, "Take off your riot gear." As well they should have, because what we're witnessing here is the increasing militarization of our police forces, which have gotten all sorts of fancy equipment and new toys in the post-9/11 era, and they seem itching to try them out, even against nonviolent protesters. This has got to stop before it gets any uglier. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
I am speaking with Sam Pizzagatti, the editor of Too Much. Now, Sam, I wanted to get to the Dodd-Frank bill. There's a provision in the bill that is trying to slow down the CEO pay raises in America. Can you talk about what that says?
Yes, there's a very interesting provision in the Dodd-Frank bill that was essentially slipped into the bill at the last minute by Senator Bob Menendez from New Jersey, who's a Democratic lawmaker. He slipped this provision into the final bill. The corporate lobbyists never saw it coming, and now they're incredibly embarrassed about it. And what the Menendez mandate does, that's the label that we put on this provision. It says that every company, every corporation in the United States, every major corporation, must annually publish the ratio between its top CEO executive pay and the pay of its median or most typical worker. In other words, on an annual basis, the corporation must reveal, does our CEO make 200, 400, 600 times what our typical worker is making? This information has never been required before. Once this sort of information becomes available, then every consumer, every worker in the United States will be able to compare individual corporations by their level of corporate executive greed. And corporate executives around the country now are moving heaven and earth to stop this provision from going into effect. They have a number of Republican lawmakers in Congress who have introduced repeal bills for this provision, and one of those bills has already passed the Key House Committee. More importantly, they're putting a great deal of pressure on the Federal Securities and Exchange Commission, which is the federal agency that essentially watchdogs corporate behavior on Wall Street. These corporate lobbyists are threatening, are pressuring the SEC to water down the regulations that have to be written to enforce this new Dodd-Frank provision. So it's been 15 months now since the Dodd-Frank bill is passed. We still don't have regulations for this new provision. But once, if we can keep this provision in the law, and if we can get this provision into effect, it can have all sorts of powerful changes on our economy. One example, we can start leveraging the power of the public purse. We can start saying that we will deny all federal contracts to companies that pay their top executives over 25 times or over 50 times what their typical workers are making. We can start saying we're going to deny all tax breaks, all tax subsidies to corporations that overpay their executives. In other words, the potential here is enormous, which I think is why the corporate community is so desperately trying to stop this provision from going into effect.
I think it's a great provision. I think I'm glad someone snuck it in there, because it'd be great to see that. If you're making $30,000 a year and the company's not really giving you much raise, and you find out that the top CEO is making, $250 million or something like that, and with bonuses, I think there would be a little more outrage going on. So I'm really glad this is going to happen. Now, you mentioned a stat that you said 54,000. Can you repeat that stat?
Yeah, so... according to WealthX, which is a Singapore based global financial analyst company, WealthX reported last week that there are slightly over 57,000 Americans worth over $30 million. In other words, have personal fortunes at least $30 million in their personal fortunes. And these are what these people are labeled in the financial world, ultra-high net worth individuals.
And compared to other countries in the world, how many more does the U.S. have?
Phenomenally more. Of the total ultra-high net worth individual population in the world, 30% of them are in the United States. So in other words, almost a third of the super rich of the world live in the U.S. We have far more than any other country. And the wealth that these super ultra high net worth individuals hold is just gigantic. Let me just give you one statistic that sort of dramatizes how gigantic this wealth was. If we just looked at the wealth these ultra-high net worth individuals have over $30 million each, that comes to $5.9 trillion. If we put a 5% annual tax on this wealth of the ultra-rich above $30 million each, we would raise over triple the amount that the Congressional Super Committee in Washington is now trying to cut off the federal deficit.
And, of course, they're not going to do that.
Of course. Instead, they're debating cutbacks in Medicare and Social Security and all sorts of other programs. We're not broke in the United States. We have a fantastic amount of wealth in the United States. Unfortunately, that wealth is all concentrated at the top.
Now, many of these ultra-rich, a lot of them are CEOs. I don't want to say all of them, but a lot of them are CEOs. Can you compare the American CEO pay with other country CEO pay? Because really, anytime you hear anything, it's always like the workers have to make less because we're competing with other workers in other countries. And, of course, they're talking sweatshops and other things and trying to bring down the American worker salary. But you never hear them compare CEO salary to other CEOs in other countries.
And there's a good reason for that, because American CEOs make far more than CEOs in other major developed nations. Here in the United States, we talked before about U.S. CEOs making 325 times more than our workers, our average workers are making. In the UK, which is the nation that's closest to us in terms of CEO pay, that ratio is under 200 times. It varies around that 200 figure, but in other countries it's far lower. In France, in Japan, in Germany, all these nations that compete with us in the global marketplace, CEO pay typically runs 30, 40, 50, 60 times what workers make, not 200, 300, 400 times more as it is in the United States.
Now, you mentioned the Occupy movement. I want to get back to that as well. How does the Occupy movement fit into all of this?
Well, I think the Occupy movement, with its brilliant exposition of the idea that we are the 99%, has really driven home to all of us in America that the great divide in our country is between the 99%, which is almost all of us, and a very few people at the top who are the only ones benefiting from the way our economy functions is functioning these days. And that realization, that crystallization of our economic reality, step to changing that reality. So I just feel so grateful for the incredibly fine work that the Occupy movement has been doing over the past 2 months.
Was there any other time in American history that we had this type of discussion? Is that something you would have seen back in the Robin Baron age? Were they discussing this type of thing back then, 100 years ago?
Our situation today in 2011 is almost identical to the situation back in 1911, a century ago, 100 years ago. Then, as now, we had a tremendous concentration of wealth at our economic summit. Then, as now, our political system seemed to be incredibly incapable of advancing the interests of the 99%. But Americans then organized and fought, and it took over a generation. But by the 1950s, that plutocracy that so dominated the United States in the early 20th century, that plutocracy was gone. We had a United States. We still had rich people, but they were far, far less rich, and they did not have a lock grip on the political process as they had at the beginning of the 20th century. So we proved over the first half of the 20th century that we could beat back plutocracy, that we could cut plutocracy down to democratic size. Now we face that plutocracy again, and our task, our challenge, is to do what our forebears did, and that is to knock that plutocracy off its pedestal, to make the United States a nation that is trying to work for everyone.
I actually have to take another break. So you are listening to the Sarah Schultz Show, and I am Sarah Schultz. So, Sam. Hi, Sam. Welcome back.
Yes.
Now, we don't have a lot of time left, so I wanted to get to which way is it easier to fix? You know, if we've talked about the problems, we've talked about this disparity between the 1% and 99%, let alone within the 1%, but how can we fix this? Is it making changes on the state level or making the changes on the federal level? Which way would be a little easier to get us back on track?
Well, that's a very good question. I think we need to look at two things and divide the question into half. And that is, one, we need to attack inequality at its source. which is the workplace. That's the prime driver of growing wealth and income differences, and then we need to redistribute existing inequality, and that's where the tax system comes in. One of the ideas on the tax system that's very powerful that's emerged from the Occupy Wall Street movement is the idea of a financial transition tax, transactions tax, which would be a federal tax. And what we're talking about here is a very small tax on every financial transaction, every stock trade, every bond trade, every trade of an exotic financial security, a tax of 0.25 or 0.50 percent. A tax like this would not be felt by any middle-class people who trade stocks, because they don't trade that many stocks. But for financial speculators, for the big hedge funds that create billionaires every year, this tax would become a real disincentive to that sort of speculation and raise a lot of money for the public purse at the same time. So I think the struggle for a financial transactions taxes is something that could be could be a very important focus federally for the movement against inequality at the state level. Tax struggles are also pivotal. Levels of state income tax vary enormously from state to state, and some states don't have any state income tax at all. So I think state by state, we can be struggling for millionaires taxes, and that is special surcharges, state income tax surcharges on income over $1 million or $500,000. Some states have put those in. In Wisconsin, as I understand it, over recent years there have been stiff cutbacks in the top rate of state income tax on high income individuals. You know, our struggle ought to be to reverse those cuts in taxes on the rich and start working so everybody's paying their fair share. So it's hard to say. It's not all state. It's not all federal. It's a combination of both of them.
And if people want more information on any of this, where could they go to?
The best place would be inequality.org, which is the portal that we run. And then once you get to inequality.org, you can sign up to receive our weekly Too Much newsletter, which is a prime source of not only information about the state of how unequal we've become, but information about what various people all around this country and around the world, for that matter, are doing to fight back against our top-heavy distribution of income and wealth.
Okay. Well, Sam, thank you so much for coming on the Sarah Schultz Show today, and I hope to have you back on. I have so many more questions that we could even get to.
Okay. So, thank you, Sarah.
Well, thank you so much. That was Sam Pizzagatti. He is the editor of, I'm looking for my notes, I just lost my place. There we go. He is the editor of Too Much and of the website inequality.org. So I'd like to thank you for listening today. I'd like to thank my producer, Bill, for all his hard work on the show this week. You can download the show from iTunes, listen to the archive shows at www.blogtalkradio.com/Sarah Schultz, or my website at www.sarahschultzshow.com. And don't forget to tune in on Saturday at 6 p.m. to Citywide WIDE LPFM 99.1 Madison.